Chapter 2. I Got Game. Down the block from our house were the courts on Pine Street. The courts were so close that in the evenings when there was little or no traffic, I could hear every dribble, every ball hitting the rim, every player calling for a foul. I can close my eyes this very moment and still hear those beautiful sounds. Those sounds remind me of my youth. I was 7 years old when the Pine Street courts were being built. The timing couldn't have been any better. If not for those courts, I wouldn't have learned the game at such a formative age. No other courts were near our neighborhood. You can practice for hours and hours by yourself on your own court, however smooth it might be, but only when you stack up your game against that of your peers day after day do you find out whether you have what it takes. Better to find out sooner than later. The Pine Street courts featured nylon nets, not the unattractive chain nets, thank goodness, and the ground was concrete, the ball bouncing true. There was more than enough room for a kid to dream. I dreamed I was Julius Irving, who played for the NBA's Philadelphia 76ers. Dr. J, as he was called, glided through the air as if he were from some other galaxy. It took him forever to come down. When he did rejoin the rest of the human race, he would typically finish with a spectacular dunk or gorgeous underhanded floater in the lane. Talk about charisma. There has been no one in the sport like Dr. J ever since. Sorry, MJ, sorry, Magic, sorry, LeBron. Whenever one of Dr. J's games was on TV, I couldn't take my eyes off him. Yet ask anyone who knew me back then which player my game resembled, and I guarantee Dr. J won't be their answer. They will bring up his teammate, Maurice Mo Cheeks, the Hall of Fame point guard who played in the league for 15 years. I'll take Mo Cheeks, kids would say in pickup games on the playground. I couldn't have asked for a more flattering compliment. My middle name, ironically, is Maurice, and the man himself, toward the end of my career, coached me for a couple of seasons in Portland. I retired 3 steals shy of his total of 2,310. He's 6th on the all-time list. I'm 7th. You ain't ever going to catch me, he tells me whenever I see him. Mo was a point guard from an era that sadly is gone probably for good. He thought of passing first, scoring second. And while I was considered a small forward in the NBA, during my entire career, I saw myself more as a point guard. Some called me a point forward, who tried to emulate Mo and other unselfish guards like him. Only 6'1", he was on the small side for a professional basketball player. Being about 5'9" when I was in high school, I could pretend I was him, and it didn't seem as far-fetched as pretending I was the 6'7" Dr. J. Mo seemed to come from this galaxy. I hung out in my teenage years with a friend, Ronnie Martin, whom I met in grade school. Ronnie and I competed against each other in Pop Warner football and Little League baseball. We were usually the first ones at the Pine Street courts every Saturday and Sunday evening, and on weekdays in the summer, normally no later than about 2 p.m. While waiting for others to show up, we played a half-court game of one-on-one called 21. The winner was the first to 21 points, each basket worth 2 points, while free throws counted as 1. Ronnie was skinny. I weighed even less, 110 pounds at the most. He was able to push me around without too much difficulty. I didn't enjoy physical contact in those days. I was more of a finesse player, using my long arms and dribbling skills to get off high percentage shots. I won my share, so did he. One of us, or both, we told each other, was going to make it big in this game someday. We told each other a lot of things. We worked hard on every aspect of the game. Ronnie had a cousin who taught us how to shoot the ball off the glass from any position on the floor, including the top of the key, and surprisingly with no arc. As long as you hit the square in the middle of the backboard, his cousin told us, you can throw the ball as hard as you want, and in nearly every case it will fall in the basket. I practiced shooting off the glass so frequently, it became my go-to shot, and that would remain the case my whole career. Around 4 o'clock, the other players would begin to show up. Some were fresh out of high school, some much older in their 30s or 40s. Quite a few came directly from their shift at the mill. You could tell by the smell. These guys could ball. I couldn't believe how strong they were. And man, they could jump, to as high as the moon, it seemed. "You better learn how to shoot the ball really high," they would tell us, "or we are going to keep blocking your shots." They weren't kidding. The games were intense, no matter if nothing was on the line except our pride. That was plenty. Win, and you kept playing. Lose, and it could be 3 or 4 games before you got back out there, if at all. Whenever the team I played on got to 19 points, one basket from victory, I was double-teamed, which was perfect training for the double teams ahead. This being the South, the only drawback was the unbelievably oppressive heat. Guys would sometimes wait until it cooled down before showing up, and then not hesitate to kick us off the court. There was nothing we could do. They were bigger than us. Without there being any refs, players called their own fouls. Did they ever? Some guys, and I know there are a few in every playground in America, called for a foul whenever someone had the nerve to breathe on them. It is no different in the NBA, where certain individuals, and the other players know who they are, believe they are fouled every time they miss a shot. In my day, it was Adrian Dantley, the outstanding small forward best known for his years with the Pistons. "I didn't foul you," a defender would argue at Pine Street. "We'll shoot for it." "No, I'm not shooting for it," the other guy would respond. "You fouled me, and it's our ball." "I didn't foul you." On and on it went, no one close to giving in. To keep the game moving, otherwise we would still be out there, the aggrieved player took one shot from the top of the key. If he made it, his team maintained possession. If he missed, the ball was given to the opponent. Lots of times, Ronnie and I stuck around after everyone else left. We played horse over and over. That's the game where players receive a letter whenever they can't match the shot the other guy made. When it got dark, we could see the basket thanks to the streetlights. Every so often, we went out for a burger afterward. Just one, which we cut in half. That's what we could afford. If the Pine Street courts weren't available, I practiced on a court a cousin of mine put up in Grandma's yard. The court was filled with dirt, the rim attached to an old rickety light pole, the backboard made out of plywood. Some days there were no nets. Others, the nets were barely attached to the rim by a string or two. Someone would have to climb on a ladder and tie them back up. I miss those days. I could be out there for hours pretending I was Mo Cheeks or Dr. J, sometimes Larry Bird, the Boston Celtics star, taking the final shot in Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Always making it, of course. I even practiced Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's signature skyhook and became darn good at it. Some mornings I got to the dirt court very early. There were more shots to make, more moves to refine, more dreams to imagine. Too early, in Grandma's opinion.
"Put that ball down and go home," she would yell. "Do you have any idea what time it is?"
Grandma scared me when she raised her voice, and I suspect others were just as terrified. In those days, folks in our neighborhood walked through one another's yards without giving it a second thought. That bothered her to no end.
"If you come through my yard one more time," Grandma told them, "I swear I am going to shoot you."
It wouldn't have shocked me one bit. Despite the hours and hours I spent at the courts on Pine Street and in Grandma's backyard, basketball wasn't my favorite sport growing up. Football was. In the South, football was and still is a religion. I played wide receiver in 7th and 8th grade and was certainly talented enough to have made the starting lineup in high school. I was fast, possessed excellent hands, and ran precise routes. Except there was an obstacle I couldn't overcome. The kid competing against me was the mayor's nephew. Many in my position would probably have walked away at that point. Not me. I became one of the team's managers. That's how much I loved the sport. I washed uniforms, handed out water bottles, and traveled on the bus with the players and the coaches to road games. I felt as if I were a member of the team. There was another reason I stuck around. Football gave me an excuse to spend more time away from the house, away from the trips to the grocery store and cleaning diapers. I wouldn't get home from practice until about 6 o'clock, just in time for supper. Most of the chores to help out with Ronnie or Dad had been done by then. I loved my family. They meant the world to me. I was just tired of our house feeling more like a hospital than a home. Everything was going pretty well until early in my junior year, when Coach Wayne said he needed to talk to me. Coach Wayne, his first name was Donald, was in charge of the basketball team and was one of the assistant football coaches. He had the reputation of being a tough guy. It was well deserved. If a player was caught talking in class or showed up late to practice, Coach Wayne didn't hesitate to discipline you. Corporal punishment was still around when I was in high school, and I don't recall parents raising any objections. "When are you going to quit being the manager and join us for the off-season workouts?" he asked me. "I will come in after football season is over," I answered, rather nonchalantly. I saw no reason to work out. None. Besides, it dawned on me that a half dozen other guys on the basketball team competed in both sports, and Coach Wayne didn't expect them to lift weights while the football season was still going on. What made me any different? Wrong answer. Coach Wayne kicked me off the basketball team. I never felt so low. I wasn't even permitted to come to the gym to shoot baskets on my own. This went on for weeks. I was sure my basketball career was over. Just then, someone came to the rescue. Michael Ireland was Coach Wayne's assistant. He was my basketball coach in junior high. He saw something in me Coach Wayne didn't. Every few days, Coach Ireland pleaded with Coach Wayne to let me back on the team. The answer was no. Coach Wayne's rules were in place for a reason, and he wasn't about to make an exception. He had kicked out plenty of others for not lifting weights and didn't give it a second thought. There was always another kid who could take his place. I realized how much I was missing out by Dad not being the man he used to be. He would have stood up to Coach Wayne, and it might have made a difference. My brother Billy pleaded my case. Bless his heart, he tried. Only Billy wasn't my father. One day, out of nowhere, Coach Wayne decided to let me back in. I have Coach Ireland to thank. Without him speaking up, I doubt Coach Wayne would have changed his mind. And I would probably never have had the life I did. Like some of the kids I grew up with, I might still be in Hamburg, maybe even working at the paper mill. None of my dreams coming true. Coach Wayne demanded something in return. Not only would I have to take part in the workouts, he made me run up and down the stairs in the bleachers after practice every single day. How many stairs? Beats me. I lost count. He was trying to find out how committed I was to the game of basketball and to my future. Good question. I hated to run those bleachers, but I believe someone told me, or perhaps I knew it deep in my gut, that if I stopped running, I would be kicked off the team for good. Yet on one occasion, I nearly did. The weather was hot and humid, and I had just practiced for an hour, if not longer. Coach Wayne could kick me off the team, get me expelled, ship me off to a military school up north. I didn't give a damn. Anything would be better than running up and down one more freaking stair. Fortunately, a couple of my teammates wandered by and noticed I wasn't running. They knew what the penalty would be and how devastated I would feel if I gave up. Perhaps not that day, or the next day, or the day after that. but for the rest of my life.
Come on, Pip,
they shouted. Everyone called me Pip.
You can do it.
That was all the encouragement I needed. I ran the bleachers that afternoon and every afternoon from then on. I never again came close to giving up. I still felt I was being unfairly punished. Only what could I do? This was the South. I was black, Coach Wayne was white, and although I never thought of him as a racist, it was impossible to ignore who we were and where we were and the times we lived in. Back then, I thought he was trying to hold me back. I couldn't have been more mistaken. He was hoping to instill in me a purpose, a sense of right and wrong, which no one except for my mom had ever bothered to teach me. I was too young and full of myself to realize it. One day, I woke up. Thank God it wasn't too late. Coach Wayne asked me to come to his office for another chat. What did I do wrong now? Could be almost anything. What do you want to do in life? He asked me. I was taken aback. No one had ever asked a question like that. In the Pippin household, there wasn't time to talk about what career I might be interested in. As for going to college, give me a break. The subject never came up. I want to play professional basketball, I told him without the slightest hesitation. There, I said it. He didn't seem surprised in the least. I was pretty sure I wasn't the first player he ever coached to be sharing this particular dream. Then, son, you better get those grades together, he said. If you don't, you're not going anywhere. Coach Wayne was right. If I didn't get serious about my grades, and a heck of a lot more than that, I wasn't going anywhere. The clock was ticking. High school, one of the final stops before joining the real world, would soon be coming to an end. My whole mindset changed. I started to approach the bleachers as a friend, not an enemy. My legs will become stronger, I told myself. I will jump higher. I will have stamina at the end of the game while everyone else is running out of gas. Day after day, I worked on my shooting, defense, and ball handling. I was on a mission to become a star, not just in high school, in college, and one day, I hoped, the NBA. The work didn't pay off. Not yet. In junior year, Coach Wayne started Ronnie Martin, my best friend, over me. Nothing against Ronnie. He was a fine player. But I was better in every phase of the game. I was better than some of the seniors. Whenever we were getting our butts kicked, I sat on the bench thinking that we wouldn't be in this predicament if I were leading the offense. I didn't let it drag me down. I realized how fortunate I was to be on the team at all. It could easily have gone the other way. Soon the season was over. For me, the hard work was just beginning. During the summer between my junior and senior years, I spent countless hours on the court and in the weight room. I practiced with Myron Jackson, who had just graduated and would be playing in the fall for the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Myron, a distant cousin, proved there was indeed a way out of Hamburg. I don't recall every game from senior year. That was a long time ago, and there have been many games since. I do recall that the Hamburg Lions were quite a team. Coach Ireland and Coach Wayne complemented each other perfectly. Coach Ireland focused on the defense, while Coach Wayne was a fabulous X's and O's guy. In a typical 2-hour practice, we worked for 45 minutes on defense. On zone, man-to-man, half-court press, full-court press, you name it. To Coach Ireland, everything was about angles and moving faster than the basketball. We forced opponents to throw the ball over the top. By the time it came down, we were in an ideal defensive posture. It's how you come up with the deflections and steals that often spell the difference between winning and losing. If you couldn't play defense on our team, you couldn't play, period. I thought we spent too much time on defense. Everyone did. Stopping the other team wasn't nearly as much fun as putting the ball in the basket. How wrong I was. The time spent was worth every second and would benefit me in ways I never anticipated. Take the Bulls' first appearance in the NBA Finals against the Lakers in 1991. Phil put me on Magic Johnson early in Game 2 after Michael picked up his second foul. Michael couldn't contain Magic in Game 1, and that's one of the reasons we lost. I tried to keep the ball out of Magic's right hand, where he was most dangerous. How I did that came from the techniques I first learned from Coach Ireland. We beat the Lakers handily that day and took the series in 5 games. One moment from senior year stands out. We were playing McGee, a school about an hour from Hamburg. I raced toward the basket after catching the ball from Ronnie. No one was anywhere near me. Normally, I would have gone in for a routine layup. That was one of the fundamentals drilled into us from day one. Not this time. The ham in me, and he is liable to come out at any moment, decided, forget the fundamentals. Flying down the lane in my finest Dr. J impression, I jumped as high as I possibly could and slammed it home. My teammates flew off the bench and didn't take a seat for the longest time. Unless I am mistaken, the official gave us a technical. No one cared. We could have received 10 technicals and still beaten McGee. For the rest of the season, I went for a dunk at every opportunity I could. We finished the regular season 23-3, going undefeated in our conference. At one point, we were ranked in our class by the Arkansas Gazette as the number one team in the state. Our big men, Ira Tucker and Stephen White, scored inside and controlled the boards, while Ronnie and I ran the offense. At 6'1", I was the point guard, although depending on the matchups, I could play any position, including center. By observing the game from different vantage points, I learned a lot at both ends of the floor. I was excited to be named to the all-district team. Other lessons I learned were just as vital. None more profound or enduring than the lessons dealing with race. I saw how the color of your skin factored into basketball. Coach Wayne sometimes put in inferior white kids over blacks vying for the same position. I don't mean to single him out. That was happening all over the South. And if he didn't put the white boys in, the school would find a coach who would. There was nothing we could do. To keep our spirits up, we used to tell ourselves, wait your turn. Eventually, in most cases, talent would win out. One white kid transferred to Hamburg High from a private school prior to senior year. Some thought he would start over me. I beat him out, just as I beat out the kid who had gotten the nod over me in football. It wouldn't have mattered if he'd been Governor Bill Clinton's nephew. That's how much better I was. Being black meant never forgetting who you were and where you were. A bunch of us used to go on occasion to Coach Ireland's house for a bite to eat or to hang out. Coach Ireland was black. We didn't go to Coach Wayne's house. Nothing against Coach Wayne personally. It was just that with him being white, he lived in a white neighborhood. Stay on your side of the tracks. As the number one seed in the regionals, we felt good about our chances to win the state. We didn't come close. In our first game, Stamps, a school a couple of hours to the west, beat us 45-43. What hurt our cause, besides missing shots, was foul trouble. I was as guilty as anyone else. I fouled out with about a minute to go. Just like that, my high school career was over. Once I got over the disappointment, I realized how much I had to be thankful for. I proved to myself that if I put in the work, I could play the game I loved at a high level. Only now what? The top colleges in the region had already signed the players they wanted. I spoke on the phone to assistant coaches from Southern Arkansas and Magnolia and the University of Arkansas in Monticello, though to the best of my knowledge, no college head coaches ever came to see me play. It was as if I didn't exist. Coach Wayne came through again, asking me, "What are your plans now?" "I want to play college ball." "How are you going to do that? You're just a puny kid."
"Gee, coach, please tell me how you really feel."
All kidding aside, he saw a lot of potential in me, as Coach Ireland had from the beginning, and vowed to help in any way he could. He was a man of his word.
Coach Wayne reached out to Don Dyer, the well-regarded coach of the University of Central Arkansas in Conway, 2.5 hours from Hamburg. Coach Wayne had played for him at Henderson State in the 1960s.
"He's a little small and needs to lift weights, but this kid can definitely play," Coach Wayne told him. "Can you take a look?"
"Sure," Coach Dyer said. "Bring him over here." Before I knew it, my brother Billy and I were on our way to Conway. When we got to the gym, Coach Dyer rounded up a couple of guys and told me to show him what I could do.
Nothing was on the line.
Nothing except my future.
I wasn't on the court for long, 20 minutes tops. The best coaches don't need a lot of time to determine whether somebody has what it takes.
The other players were much bigger than I was. I weighed roughly 160 pounds. Coach Wayne was right. I was puny. Even so, I felt confident afterward that I had more than held my own, and Coach Dyer would be impressed. Then again, what did I know? He could tell Coach Wayne he had done what he'd been asked, but I wasn't a good fit for his team. That would be the end of it. No college coach has a spot for every player who tries out.
"Coach Dyer wants to see you in his office," someone said.
I knocked on his door. He got right to the point.
"You looked pretty good out there.
What do you have going on?"
He was referring to my options for college.
"Coach, I have nothing going on."
He made me an offer. Sort of.
"We have signed our players for the upcoming season, but I can get you into a work-study program. You won't be allowed to play in any games, but you'll be able to work out with the rest of the team. How does that sound?"
I don't recall him saying, "Take it or leave it," though that was clearly the impression I was getting.
I took it.
No, it wasn't a scholarship, but here was someone who wanted me, Scotty Maurice Pippen, from Hamburg, Arkansas. No one else wanted me. I would naturally have to prove myself when the opportunity came, if it came, but that I could do, just as I did for Coach Wayne. My brother and I got in the car and headed home. I don't remember a thing about the drive. My mind was a million miles away. I couldn't have been more excited. I was going to college.
Chapter 3. Bigger Man on Campus. I spent the summer of 1983 lifting weights and putting up a million shots from every spot on the floor, going for the bank and the square in the middle as much as possible. Ronnie still kicked my butt every so often in one-on-one at Pine Street, which was fine with me. Losing made me better, hungrier. That was true my entire career. After a couple of months, summer was over, and I was on my way to Conway, to a new life. I was anxious, to say the least. A new life meant becoming acquainted with a new group of people, and that was never easy for me, except for road trips to games in high school and the occasional visit to my mom's relatives in Louisiana. I didn't take one step outside the city limits of Hamburg. A whole world was out there that I knew nothing about. From my first day on campus, the focus was basketball. Basketball was my ticket to the future, nothing else. I spent every day at the gym, which was a short walk from the dorm. My goal was to show Coach Dyer and his staff a different player than the frail youngster they saw in the spring. Mission accomplished. I still had a long way to go. Every other player on the floor was on scholarship except me. No problem, I told myself.
I would wait for my turn. A few weeks later, it came sooner than I imagined. Two students left the program, and suddenly there was a scholarship with my name on it. With Coach Dyer, as I would later discover, guys were constantly coming or going. He would never stop searching for the unknown gem who had somehow slipped by everyone else. That player was out there, somewhere. He just had to find him. Once, when the team was on the road, having dinner at McDonald's after a game, Coach Dyer spotted a kid standing in line who was 6'5", maybe taller. Coach immediately stopped what he was doing and approached him. "How old are you? Do you have any eligibility left?" The kid must have thought the man was off his rocker. I can't overstate how much it meant to be on scholarship. College wasn't cheap, but even though I didn't see myself as being poor, I most definitely was. My expenses were less than other students because I was in a work-study program and the recipient of a Pell Grant. Still, they were substantial enough. I was always looking for a way to save a few bucks. After finishing supper in the cafeteria, I would go back in line to stuff a couple of ham and cheese or turkey sandwiches in my backpack. I'd stick them in the microwave before going to bed. I ate 4 meals a day, not 3. To me, the scholarship was about much more than receiving financial support. I was now truly part of the team. I hadn't felt that way before. Being part of the team meant having to give what Don Dyer expected from his players. A lot. And I thought Coach Wayne was demanding. You know the saying, my way or the highway? Coach Dyer said it so often, you might think he invented it. He made us practice constantly. Once, I kid you not, on Christmas. On some occasions, if we had just been beaten pretty decisively on the road, he would have everyone stay for a walk-around practice when we arrived back in Conway, no matter how late it might be. Like my teammates, I did whatever he wanted. I hadn't forgotten what happened the last time I didn't listen to my coach. To a point, that is. One time, when he was working us right to the edge, if not over the edge, I walked off the court. I didn't care if practice wasn't over. "Fuck this, my feet are killing me," I said. "I'm out of here." If anyone else had pulled a stunt like that, Coach Dyer would have booted him off the team right then and there. Except by this point, I was our best player, and one of the best in the Arkansas Intercollegiate Conference. He couldn't afford to get rid of me. "We're done," he said. "See you all tomorrow." Coach wasn't always that lenient with me. We lost one game because I went for the dunk in the closing seconds instead of trying to tip it in. The ball bounced off the back of the rim. Coach Dyer was beside himself. In his view, I had committed a mortal sin, an affront to the basketball gods. In the locker room afterward, he said I needed to apologize to the whole team. Fat chance. "We aren't going anywhere then," he said. "Come and get me when Scotty is ready. I don't care how long we have to wait." I stood my ground for a half hour, maybe longer. Apologize? For what? I wanted to win as badly as anyone else. I just made a mistake. Sue me. Besides, if anyone needed to apologize, it was Coach Dyer for keeping us here this long. My teammates were on my side. On the other hand, they also wanted to go home. It had been a long day. "Pip, we know it wasn't your fault," they said. "Just tell him you're sorry so we can get the hell out of here." "Go get him." When Coach Dyer arrived, I said what he wanted to hear. I couldn't have been more insincere. "See you tomorrow," he told everyone. Then there was the time I missed the bus, literally. I was taking a class that started at 1 o'clock. The bus was scheduled to leave from our facility, the Ferris Center, at 2 to take us to Magnolia for a game that evening. I knew I would be cutting it close, but figured if I could sneak out a couple of minutes early, I'd make it in time. The Ferris Center wasn't far away. Besides, if I was a little late, no sweat. I was an AA, All-American, as I used to tell everyone. They wouldn't dare leave me behind.
So much for being an AA.
Luckily, I was bailed out by a gentleman named David Lee, who ran Chickadilly, a restaurant on campus the team visited regularly. Mr. Lee was a big booster of the basketball program and a friend of Coach Dyer's. When I ran into Mr. Lee an hour or two later and explained what had happened, he practically threw me into his Cadillac. He must have been going close to 80 the whole way to Magnolia. When I got to the gym, about 7 minutes remained in the first half. Everyone was surprised to see me, including Coach Dyer, who didn't call my number until about 6 minutes had gone by in the second half. I assumed he was punishing me. Only he couldn't punish me for long. We trailed by 3 when I checked in. I scored 11 points the rest of the way, and we won by 6. I never missed the bus again. Coach often kept us at practice past 6 o'clock. Guys hated that. The cafeteria closed at 6. Someone would call over there to tell them we were running late and ask if they could keep it open for a few extra minutes. The answer was usually yes. If they couldn't, Mr. Lee was more than happy to feed us. I will say this about Don Dyer, who passed away earlier this year. He went over every aspect of the game as thoroughly as any coach I ever played for. And that includes Phil Jackson. He won more than 600 games and ended up in the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, NAIA, Hall of Fame. Like a mathematician working on a new theory, he was constantly drawing up a new play on the board in his office.
"Do you think this will work?" he would ask anyone who stopped by.
Yet no individual had a more profound and lasting impact on the team than Arch Jones, our assistant coach. While Coach Dyer focused on the plays, Coach Jones, or Coach J as we fondly called him, focused on the people. He helped us think of the lives we would be living long after we were finished with basketball, or basketball was finished with us. What kind of fathers would we be? What kind of husbands? What kind of citizens? Coach J was raised by his mom. His dad died before he was born. When he was in high school, his basketball coach cared for him deeply. I believe that was why he went into the coaching business, to guide those youngsters who needed a role model, just as his coach was there for him. Whenever Coach Dyer got on a player's case, Coach J would wait for the right moment and assure the kid that what he did or did not do wasn't as horrible as what he was led to believe. There's no telling how many young men Coach J kept from losing their confidence. I could talk to him for hours. We talked about a lot more than basketball. We talked about life. I wasn't that open with anyone else outside my family. In addition to Amy, his sweet daughter who was developmentally disabled, I got to know his other two children and his remarkable wife, Artie. Her strength in coping with Amy's accident reminded me a lot of my own mom. Coach J was there for me in other ways, too. When I needed money for gas or other basic necessities, he gave me a 10 spot or a 20 without any hesitation. That added up to a couple of thousand easy. Looking back, I'm sure that violated NCAA rules. Truth is, I wouldn't have made it through all 4 years without his help. To ask my family for another dime was simply out of the question. Many college athletes today find themselves in the same situation, which is why I agree with those who call for them to be compensated. And with this year's Supreme Court decision, we are headed in that direction. Don't give me any of that holier-than-thou student-athlete nonsense. These young men and women are athletes first, not students, and make up the labor that generates fortunes for their schools. They are, for lack of a better term, slaves. During my freshman year, I averaged only 4.3 points and 3 rebounds. No matter. I came to Central Arkansas, remember, as a walk-on, assuming I would sit out the whole year. Instead, I played in 20 games. That was more games than the freshmen who were recruited and on scholarship from day one.
Off the court, to my pleasant surprise, I made plenty of friends and discovered I could survive just fine on my own. I felt so comfortable on campus, I stuck around the summer after freshman year and the next two summers as well. Conway was where my life was now, not Hamburg. The schedule I kept in the summer between my job and basketball was insane. From 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., I worked the graveyard shift at Verco, a welding plant that built home and office furniture. The work was extremely dangerous. Fall into a batch of acid, and you might not make it out alive. I suffered my share of burns, leaving some nasty scars I still have on my shoulders. My job was to dig into boxes to take out the legs two at a time and put them on the chairs using a four-pedal automatic machine. The welded metal was unbelievably hot. You needed to wear two pairs of gloves. Even that didn't necessarily protect you. It was worth the risk. The money was tremendous. The company paid you depending on how many chairs you put together in each shift. I could usually assemble about 300, unless it got too hot. Some days, the temperature inside the plant was well over 100 degrees. I earned about $750 a week, saving close to $5,000 that first summer. To someone from my background, it was like winning the lottery. When my shift ended, I drove home for a short workout, caught 6 or 7 hours of sleep, then got right back in the car, heading to Little Rock about a half hour away to compete in what was known as the Dunbar Summer League. Some of the top players from around the state participated. We used to tell ourselves, no scrubs allowed. Among the regulars was Pete Myers, a future teammate of mine with the Bulls. Pete was about to start his junior season at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock after transferring from a community college in Alabama. I more than held my own against Pete and the others. Around 9 p.m., I would drive back to Conway, take a shower, grab a quick bite, and be back at the plant by 11. Insane, I tell you. And productive. I was ready to take my game to a whole new level. Something else happened in the summer of 1984, and it would change everything. I grew. I had wondered for quite some time why I wasn't as tall as my brothers, who each stood well over 6 feet. I started to worry I might not grow another inch. Then it happened. I grew 4 inches to 6'5" and wasn't done yet. I would eventually end up around 6'7". Anyone who hadn't seen me for a while, the first thing they usually brought up was my height. Man, you're getting up there. The added size would serve me well. I already possessed the passing skills of a point guard. Now I could employ those skills against smaller defenders. If guys doubled me, I would be able to see above them and easily spot the open man. The only negative was that because I didn't have to shoot much from the outside to be effective, that element of my game didn't improve and would need some fine-tuning in the NBA. I couldn't wait to show off to Coach Dyer and Coach Jones in practice and see how this new and improved version of myself would perform in the games themselves. Unfortunately, I would have to wait. In the fall of 84, I was placed on academic suspension. I had no one to blame but myself. The semester before, being on my own, I was so eager to find out what I had been missing that I had neglected my studies. Now it was time to pay the price. I don't recall what the minimum grade point average was at Central Arkansas. Safe to say, I was not anywhere near it. I approached the problem the way I approached running the bleachers in high school. Make academics my friend, not my enemy. I received help from tutors and classmates and went to the library for the first time. I was no Einstein, but by the end of the fall semester, my grades were decent enough. I was clear to play. And play I did. I led the conference in scoring 18.5 points, and rebounds, 9.2, and with the guys we had returning and the arrival of guard Jimmy McClain, a transfer from the University of Arkansas at Monticello, The expectations would be high come junior year. Consider them met. We captured our first outright conference title since 1965 with a record of 23-5, though one of those losses came in the district championship game against the Boll Weevils from UA Monticello. The team messed up at the end. Correction, I messed up at the end. On the first possession of overtime, I missed a dunk. That was upsetting enough. On the final possession with 3 seconds to go, I missed a layup that would have tied the game, the ball going around the rim and out. I had played well up to that point with 19 points, 10 rebounds, 4 steals, and 2 blocked shots. Big deal. I failed in the clutch, and that's what mattered. As a result, the Boll Weevils, and not the Central Arkansas Bears, were headed to the NAIA's national tournament in Kansas City. I felt awful for the rest of the guys, the seniors primarily, and for myself. Gone was the opportunity to appear on a national stage, and there was no guarantee I would get another. I craved the stage so much that even before my sophomore year had ended, I looked into the possibility of transferring to the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. Nothing was bigger in the state of Arkansas than being a Razorback, and I wouldn't have cared if they had offered me a scholarship or not. Just let me put on a uniform and work out with everyone else, and I'd find a way to make it as a walk-on, as I'd made it in Conway. The Razorbacks had a new head coach, Nolan Richardson, who had turned the program around at Tulsa, winning the NIT in 1981. He possessed one of the brightest basketball minds in America and would be the first black man to lead a major school in the South. To play for Coach Richardson would be a privilege. When Arch Jones found out I was exploring the idea, he tracked me down right away. I was ready for him. "This isn't working out," I said. "I need to play somewhere else." I was a Division I talent, trapped in what was essentially a Division II school, afraid I would never be discovered. This was long before the internet. Today, if a player is any good, he won't stay under the radar for long. By going to U of A, I told Coach J, I would be seen by NBA scouts and have an opportunity to hone my skills by competing against the top players. And in all likelihood, I would experience the thrill of March Madness. As a kid, I watched the NCAA basketball tournament year after year. Like millions of others, I couldn't keep my eyes off the screen when Larry Bird, Indiana State, and Magic Johnson, Michigan State, went at each other in the spring of 1979. College basketball would never be the same. Coach J waited for me to finish, then made his pitch. "The opportunity will be there. I promise. I will call scouts and make sure people find you." I appreciated how he treated me as a human being and not as a commodity. Coach J sincerely believed I would be happier in Conway, and in the end, he was right. With the talent level as deep as it was, I might easily have been lost in Fayetteville or another Division I school. Remaining in Conway, I kept getting better and better. The same could be said of the team itself. In senior year, Ronnie Martin was our point guard, and Robbie Davis our best shooter. I rotated from one position to the next, depending on the size and speed of our opponents. Coach Dyer was his usual demanding self. Having been around the guy for 3 seasons, I knew what to expect. We won our conference again, but came up short once more in the NAIA District 17 tournament. I thought the loss to Monticello the year before was heartbreaking. That loss was nothing compared to the game against the Harding Bisons, who beat us in the semifinals 88-87. We should never have lost that game. I repeat, never. A month earlier, we destroyed them 84-54, and that was in their building. This game was in our building. How can that happen? I'll tell you. They had a 5'8" senior guard by the name of Tim Smallwood, I swear I'm not making that name up, who went out of his mind hitting 7 of 11 threes, while a freshman, Corey Camper, another name out of Central Casting, nailed a 3 from 23 feet with 5 seconds remaining to put the Bisons on top by 1. Camper found himself wide open on the right wing. His coach was screaming for a timeout. Just our luck that this kid didn't hear him and proceeded to hit the shot of his life. We still had one last chance to pull it out. After we called time, I drove the length of the court to about 10 feet from the basket, but took too long and was unable to get a shot off before the buzzer sounded. I scored 39 points and pulled down 12 rebounds. One of my best games, right? Wrong. How could it be? I failed again to lead my team to victory. I was 8 for 15 from the line, and that killed us. If I had made just 2 more free throws, we would have moved on. As soon as the horn sounded, I fell to the floor and cried. I don't know how long I was on my knees. It felt like an eternity. My college career was over. Gone as well was my last opportunity to go to Kansas City for the NAIA tournament. March Madness? Perhaps not. Scouts from the NBA would be there nonetheless. The year before, a player from another NAIA school, Southeastern Oklahoma State, scored 46 points and had 32 rebounds in one of those games. That player would be drafted in the second round by the Detroit Pistons. His name? Dennis Rodman. Though I led the conference in points, 23.2, and rebounds, 10, for the third year in a row, while finishing second in assists, I felt the same as I did after finishing high school. Now what? My personal life was also up in the air. During junior year, a friend introduced me to Karen McCollum. Karen became my first girlfriend. That's how shy I was around the opposite sex, dating back to junior high. Before long, Karen and I fell in love. I could see the two of us settling down one day and having a family. Except there was another love in my life. Basketball. That was bound to be a problem.